Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 27th, 2016, and welcome to episode 142 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
ERCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and replicas, precise or otherwise. Welcome to the end of November. We have a very full table today, starting with Carrington in Toronto. Ooh. How are you?
I am Carrington in Toronto, which is the best place to keep a Carrington.
Yes.
Far, far away.
We can run free in Toronto.
Free-range Carringtons.
Yes. There are off-leash Carringtons in Toronto.
Has it snowed there?
It has snowed here. There's no snow at the moment, but we have already had our initial dusting, which has come and thankfully gone.
Excellent, excellent. Pretty much the same here. We saw a little bit, but it didn't stay. I mean, I did actually witness there being snow on the ground, though. Okay, moving over to Portland, we have Earl Evans. How are you?
Well, as my dad used to say, better than you are.
Yeah.
So, I'm doing fine, Paul. Thank you.
Excellent. Yeah. Moving to what's next. Let's go to Sweden with Jack. How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good. I am just full of Thanksgiving cheer, shall we say?
Cheer was in quotes.
Excellent. Liquid Thanksgiving cheer.
I think that's the phrase.
Thanksgiving is a little later in Sweden.
Yeah, because we don't have that Thursday and Friday off, so we always do our Thanksgiving dinner on Saturday. And here it's...
I thought you were going to say we don't have Thursday and Friday.
Yeah, those have been eliminated in the name of socialism.
They have metric weeks.
I was going to say, there's no way you don't have a day named after Thor. You probably have all your days named after Thor.
That's right. Every last one of them.
Excellent. And Michael in Australia, how are you? Has it snowed yet?
Oh, it hasn't snowed down here. Yes, the last few days have been almost nudging 30 in the shade. So that's 30°C, not in Fahrenheit. So it's been stinking hot, but lovely. Been great weather. Yep. And I've just hold on a sec. I've just finished an eBay purchase. Okay, you've got my attention.
Yeah. So did you get the Tandy 600 or whatever it was? No.
There was
something that was going to end right at the right when we started recording, but
I
opted not. Okay, so welcome everybody. We have a nice full table, and we should probably begin. So I am the host today. Oh, I'm Paul, by the way. I don't think I actually said my name. So I'm the host, and today the topic that I have picked is replicas. So, you know, we circle around the same topics relatively frequently. I think we've talked about replicas before, but the thing I was, I guess, wondering about in this case is that for some reason I've had a number of replicas come to my attention recently, and you know, so we'll talk. Actually, maybe I can point ahead to them. There's an eBay seller who is reproducing a bunch of Apple II software, so they're, you know, with new labels, modern made labels on discs and reproduced manuals, and they look very nice. They would reproduce the experience that you would have had back in the 80s if you had just gotten them. They look quite real. On eBay, I noticed there was a Kenback 1 replica that showed up, and it looks just like a Kenback 1, except new, and looks very nice. And I guess part of the thing I was wondering about is, what do we think about the idea that we're trying to reproduce the experience, which you do like with a non-yellowed thing, and you know, discs that work and stuff like that? Or is it better to actually be holding the history? And I know another thing that I was worried about with the replicas is if person A buys this replica, you know, from an honest seller who says, this is a replica, look how much like the original it looks like, and then person A lists it on eBay, you know, are we at risk? I mean, not that we can do anything about it, but I worry a little bit about replicas being bought and then resold to someone who doesn't know it's a replica. So anyway, just random thoughts about that, but I guess we can maybe just kind of go around the table to see what other people's random thoughts are. So Carrington, you are first.
Lock them all up. No, like, I am totally fine with replicas. I do think the only issue comes down to them being passed off as non-replicas, because a lot of people do put stock and value into original things. So you're right, when person B goes and starts selling it off, if they're not careful on their eBay listing, so that could become an issue. I have no problem with replicas themselves. I think I, though, have a very, very interesting relationship with copyright, an adversarial one, so maybe I'm not the best person to talk about these things. I do think that wasn't the Apple One, like, if you look at something like that, that's one of these few retro devices that sells for quite a bit of money, so there could be more motivation to pass something off. And I think the very close replica wasn't a replica of that. There's something in it that lets you know that it's not real, some small intentional difference. And so maybe that's the key. Maybe it's just that you have to, like, if you buy this Kenback One, the first thing you do when you get it is you say, describe in single words only the good things that come into mind about your mother. And depending on how it reacts, you know whether it's real or not. Wait, that's replicant. Sorry. Anyway, I'm fine with all these things. Welcome me back to the show. Have you missed me?
Nice, nice. Yeah, the Apple One, so there are a couple of different Apple One replica boards. I know the Mimio One that Mike Willigal makes has something. There is something that you can detect on it. And I think there were a couple others. I'm not sure, actually, about the Newton one. And there was one more that, the third one that I'm not remembering the name of, is actually a little bit more detectably. It just looks different. Because you actually, on the Apple One, everybody had to guess how the traces went under the chips, because everyone was working from a picture. So yes, Earl, you are next on my list. What do you think?
I have mixed feelings about this. I think that some of the software packages that are really hard to find in good condition, in terms of, you know, something you'd like to have, but if you find it, it's all marked up and yellowed and that kind of thing. I think it might be fun to have a replica, a reproduction of it in that case. But I might not have the same kind of nostalgic feel about it as I would if I actually had the original. Another thing that I think is that I feel like it would be incumbent on the person making the reproductions to at least see if they could find the people who had originally made the product and get their permission. And I think this, especially in terms of software, in terms of hardware, yeah, you know, like you and Carrington have both said, if there's a little bit of a difference on there so that you can tell it from the original, then that, you know, that's fine. In terms of the software, a lot of these people are still around. If you could go find them and say, hey, this piece of software is really popular, people would like the faux experience of having a brand new one, what do you think? And if they give you a thumbs up, then I say go for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true. I guess I was thinking, too, that my recollection of the experience in the 80s was not of using a, like, tattered, you know, thing with stuff drawn all over it that says, like, please return to, like, Mr. Steve or something like that. That, you know,
exactly.
Not, you know, then that's the one I could get now. So there is a sense in which some sort of reproduction might enhance nostalgia, too. It's tricky. It's continuing in the same order, though. Jack, any thoughts?
Yeah.
In your wine-addled state?
Sure. I think
we were going to talk about that, Paul.
No, I think...
Oh, I'm going to talk about that.
I think a couple of thoughts came to mind. One, the first I was thinking of is that I watch things like the Antique Roadshow, right? Where one of the things they'd always talk about is people come in with some old thing that they've got, or an old painting or whatever, and sometimes they have a suspicion. They think they don't know if this is the actual thing or not. And sometimes they're just totally clueless and think it's real, and it's like, no, this is actually a replica. But that oftentimes even the replicas are worth something as well. It's like, oh, this is a replica, but it's also from, like, it's from 1720. So it's, you know, it's pretty old also, and it's worth something. And I think that it's interesting to think that people who have kind of our particular bent, our particular interest in computers, could at some point act as experts, not necessarily on that show, but in a case where, you know, at some point there will be a thing where someone looks at a motherboard that someone says, hey, this is an Apple One, and someone's going to have to decide, well, is that really or not? It's interesting to me that, at some point we could be dealing with things that are intentionally or not functionally counterfeit, mm-hmm. but are, you know, at some point almost as old as the original thing, say, you know, in decades from now, and people will not generally know the difference. And the second,
or care, because what are the odds of any of this stuff being really actually valuable long term to
right,
most people?
Right.
To be honest, like, I love this stuff, but
mm-hmm. yeah. But the other thing that came to mind was a bit on along the lines of what you mentioned, Paul, was that the computers we were using 30 and 40 years ago are not, you know, they were not in the shape they're in now. And that's why we enjoy seeing things like TV shows that are set in the 80s where they're using computers from that time and they're new. And it's like, oh, wow, cool. Look at that. That's what it looked like. Because today it doesn't look like that. We're dealing with stuff that is older and aged, and it's like, that can be sort of fun to see something that actually is a new product built today that looks just like something built decades ago. So, I mean, I think it's fine, but it may lead to some confusion sometimes for some people, but, ah.
Michael, how about you? Is there anything left?
There's a few things. Yeah, I like getting hold of software. More importantly, I like getting hold of the manuals and everything that comes with it. But as much as I love getting stuff which is in as new condition, I really like the ones which have got the person's margin notes in it, or other little bits and pieces that's been added to it. I just love collecting the essence, as I like to call it, the essence of the use of the manual. As to reproductions, you know, we've entered an era where you can even quite easily reproduce box packaging, I suppose, as long as the manufacturer is flying a little bit loose on the copyright issue. But no, I've seen some quite good retro themed or styled packaging that things get put in. I just bought a power supply for a Apple IIc Plus, and it comes in 2C styled box. You can get them shrink wrapped and just for that there. But now, as all things can be used for good, they can also be used for evil. But
don't I know it?
Yeah, people passing it on. Yeah, I know you know it. Mr. Adversarial Copyright. But yeah, it's getting to that stage where the simpler things can be more easily reproduced. And if someone is flying very close to the edge on copyright and permissions for doing that, they can actually make some very good replicas of the boxes and the manuals. Yet to find a place that makes those lovely vinyl leather effect padded three-ring and four-ring binders of the day that you can get the gold or silver embossed trademarks and everything on it, but I'm sure someone can do it.
Oh yeah, like the TRS-80 stuff had a lot of
those. Oh yes, yeah. That's, you know, the IBM. I love collecting IBM software in the manuals, in those slip cases, because you've got the fabric heavy folder mm-hmm. ring clips and everything. It's just, as I said, it's the essence of my retro computer. Well, back then it wasn't retro computers, but it's basically the essence of me and computers over the years. Hardware is still a very small realm of people can actually do that, even if they are using fab centers in China to make the circuit boards and then doing it. Now, there's still a lot of effort, so it's a very small skill set enabled people who are making physical machine replicas. But software, pretty easy. Documentation, considerably easier than it used to be to make some very convincing manuals. So I would like to see the people who are doing the manuals, the software, that kind of thing. On the inside of the manual, on the disc label that it's put on there, on the sleeve of the disc, whatever, something that indicates that it's a replica.
It's almost too bad there's not like an international symbol for that. So you wouldn't have to have a big, this is a replica thing on it. But if there was something like an anti-copyright symbol.
Yeah, I was thinking for the anti-copyright symbol, that'd be something along the lines of a raised finger type logo, wouldn't it?
No, but some little thing, because then it could be...
Yeah.
Because I guess that's the issue. And my problem, I guess, is that since I'm not a collector and I don't necessarily value original things better than a duplicate that I can't tell the difference of. I'm just happy to hang a print on my wall, for instance, versus an original painting. But I get that it's... I'm therefore imposing my own values, because other people that really value original things and have therefore invested in them, it devalues what they own if suddenly there's knockoffs everywhere, I guess, that are indistinguishable. But at the same time, like, I know if I don't want to have a lot of stuff, I would be just as happy with a shelf full of, you know, perfect replicas that gave me the exact experience. And I was like, oh my goodness, yes, I'm going to go play this game, and it's the...
Yeah, so the perfect Christmas present for Carrington would be to flood him with reproduced suspended boxes, complete with the...
the mask.
I have, like, for instance, I have a sealed Infocom suspended box with the mask one that I sat on. It's also because I had it on my couch and I moved over and I slept, so it's also slightly crunched now, and I have yet to open it. I'm going to, but I have not even opened it. So that is like, so there's a thing that I valued enough to go seek out on eBay, and I got a really good deal on it. It's totally sealed, and I've never played it. I'm looking forward to unshrinking it, wrapping it, and playing it for the first time. That'll be awesome. But I don't think I would enjoy that any more, really, than unshrink wrapping a perfect duplicate and enjoying the experience of that. And clearly, I don't value it enough not to sit on it. So all these things are bad in my hands. I'm always unshrink wrapping stuff and wrecking things and giving them away. And so... I should have no opinion here. I'm a terrible person.
Oh. You cared just enough just to sit on it, not to stand on it.
I guess. So.
So, it's a very gray sort of area.
I like the icon idea, though.
Yeah. The copyright, the no copyright icon, yeah.
Or not even no copyright, but not original, something. Yeah, but it would be nice, I think, if that was a thing. Yeah. Anyway.
But it's more, as you said, person A does it. They do, you know, they do indicate on their eBay listing or their website that it is a replica. It's when person B gets their mitts on it and then just happens to omit that it's a replica when they go to on-sell it. That's the problem.
It's also a problem that solves itself, you know, if you think long enough term. 1,000 years from now, 2,000 years from now, 5,000 years from now, like, come on, none of these original things won't have just crumbled into dust, and we should have some form of 3D printing technology that can, you can say, I want to play an Infocom game, and so sure, give me 30 seconds, go grab a cup of tea, and bingo, sitting on your desk is a perfect shrink wrap duplicate of the Infocom game, provided we scan things at a high enough resolution now to preserve a map of the recreation. Eventually, nobody's going to care, because you can't have 1,000 years from now that, if we don't blow ourselves up, the population size spread over hopefully more than one planet means there's too few Infocom games to go around. And it's kind of not fair to say there's 300 billion people and only 200 copies of a game. That's too limited. So let's just let everybody who wants one have one. That's how they do it in Star Trek.
Yeah, we'll just have to fix that ratio.
By killing all the people.
Oh, no, I didn't say that.
All right. Modestly proposed. So, I don't know. I think that kind of went around about where I expected it to.
I'm surprised. I'm surprised there weren't more dissenting things saying, like, this is ridiculous and we love this stuff and the originals. There's got to be listeners who are very upset with the stance most of us have taken.
Well, we love originals, but they're old.
Well, they should contact us.
That's right. Yes, we'll follow the procedure of, like, saying something obviously false or something to try to get feedback.
Yeah.
Clickbait.
This is not patently false.
Yeah. It's
original clickbait.
Not reproduced clickbait.
All right. So, let's see. I'll move on to listener feedback. we had only a couple of things that I wanted to mention. So John Mark wrote in to say that the Oregon Trail board game is available again. I can't remember exactly when we talked about this in the past, but it sold at Target, and then it sort of immediately sold out. So I think Ken relayed a story of not, you know, having to go to some far-flung Target or something to get it. But it's back. It's back. I have a couple coming to me. So
originals?
Yes, they are indeed original new Oregon Trail properties. But I don't know if it's any good. I mean, you know, it's possible that just the existence of the box is the entire, you know, good part about this. But I don't know. We'll see.
Its playability could be right up there with Lode Runner.
We're hoping better.
up there. Have you ever told you guys I've never played the Oregon Trail, the original game?
Never ever?
Never ever.
Not even a
so
little
I played
bit.
The card game no. first, I think.
I haven't either.
Same here.
And I'm kind of ashamed of myself speaking.
I'm not
as a
ashamed.
Who,
it's everyone seems to play yeah. it, but
no. Yeah. But I'm actually sitting at the end of the Oregon Trail.
Oh, that's where I live.
Yeah, you're already there. You don't need to play it. Lived it.
I guess so.
And it's funny because I know the stuff. You know that you've died of dysentery, and I know how the games play this stuff. But it was never played in my schools, and so maybe it's because you know Canada. But yeah.
Well, Earl, there's your next retro challenge. You can write the Oregon Trail. I want to go back.
I guess so.
Yeah, right. Head back to wherever it is, Ohio or...
Yeah, Oregon Trail, the return home.
Yeah, it's. I think I didn't play it a lot, but I know I have played it all the way through. Not. I certainly don't have the patience to do it now, but... anyway, so thanks for the alert. And then another bit of feedback we got was from Nick on Facebook, who mentioned another Z80 kit. So we've been talking about various little like homebrew type kits that you can make, and this is the P112 single board computer. And so this was originally designed by Dave Brooks in 1996, and he sold a few of those, and then it kind of went away. And Dave Griffith. Are they really both Daves? Well, if that's what I've typed down, has taken over and is making kits. And so if you want to buy a kit, you can do that. You can get them either in sort of partial kits or mostly complete kits, and you can even get them assembled. And they are not very expensive. But so it looks like the mini kit domestically shipped is $62, and assembled domestically shipped is $112. So pretty good. And it's... Form factor is kind of cute. It's basically the size of a 3.5-inch floppy drive, so you can, you know, sort of set it on top of the floppy drive that you have connected to it. But anyway, looks sort of interesting. I haven't pursued it much more than that myself. But now there are too many Z80 kits to buy.
Well, this P112's been around for a while. This is, you know, several runs in that they've mm-hmm. done on this one, and it's been pretty popular. You know, kind of a little mini community around it.
Do you have one?
I don't have one, no.
Yeah, I'm tempted, except that I have a stack of these things that I need to solder. It's going to take me, you know, 2 months to solder everything I've already got.
Yeah, that's the thing. I got too many projects, but I do tend to like pretty much all things CPM, so I've followed this one. You know, I've been like a secret admirer.
Anyway, so I guess that's all the feedback I was going to mention, but thanks for writing, and... Yeah, we will enjoy hearing more from you in the future. So now we can turn to items of interest and news. And Earl has something. What am I supposed to say? Je me souviens.
But I guess anyway. So. Très bien, mon ami. So here is the ultimate in minimalism. So. These days, we've got 64-bit computers with 64-bit operating systems and super complex instruction sets. And one of the reasons that we like our old retro 8-bit computers is because they're simpler and it's easier to know everything there is about it. I've heard that over and over and over as I've talked to people in retro computing. Well, Mick decided that he was going to build a system out of transistors, and instead of 8 bits or even 4 bits, it would be a 1-bit CPU. And instead of 60 instructions or 200 instructions, it would have, count them, 1 instruction. So you're wondering, can I actually compute on a computer that processes one bit and has one instruction, it turns out, yes, you can. And in the process of understanding how it all works, you can get a minimalistic glimpse into computing that you can then scale up. Like, for instance, in digital design, one of the first things you learn is how to make a one-bit adder. And the one-bit adder has a carry, and so since it has a carry, you can then turn 8 of them into an 8-bit adder, or 16 of them into a 16-bit adder. You scale up. This is scaled in the opposite direction so that you can wrap your mind around it. And I cruised around quite a bit of his site. I have to say I haven't read it all yet, but I found it to be quite educational. I think if you're interested in understanding how CPUs work, the whole purpose of this is to be approachable. So, yay. And again, it's called the Quebec, Q-I-B-E-C, and you can find it at qibec.org, and we'll have that up in the show notes. And thank you, Mick, for writing in and letting us know about what you did. We love it.
Yeah, this thing is wild. I dug around in the pages as well. And I mean, like, it just seemed to me at the outset, like, what do you mean one instruction? You know, this, like, you can't do anything with that. But it's actually pretty cleverly designed one instruction. It flips a bit and then reacts based on the result.
Yes, it changes the data and it does a conditional branch all in one instruction. So if you're really clever, you could do something with that.
Yeah, I think it's very, I can imagine this taking a long time to sort of like completely comprehend, but it does feel like you could. And I actually would like to see some videos of it in action. I didn't chase any down, but I believe it has a bunch of lights and stuff in fact, I think there was he's got something like a Space Invaders game playing on whatever, on its basic display, Chase the Bit or something like that it's called. But very cool thing, though. Okay, Jack, you have something about the Jaguar.
Yeah, so the Atari Jaguar is kind of borderline topic for our podcast in a way. Because, you know, it's not a computer. It's kind of late in the game. It came out in the mid-90s, but at the same time as the PlayStation. But to me, it's kind of got a warm place in my heart. It's the last piece of any kind of hardware that Atari made, I think. Someone will tell me if I'm wrong, I'm sure. And it always had, like, from the start, it had some games that were already very retro-themed. It had these games like Tempest 2000 and Defender 2000 that built on earlier arcade games and made them sort of newer and fresher and kind of psychedelic. They were programmed by Jeff Minter, and it was all sorts of crazy colors flying everywhere. So anyway, today, in this modern day and age, there's a new game coming out for the Jaguar called Rebooteroids, which is, of course, an Asteroids update. And it's got some funky colors and crazy graphics and things. And you buy the game, it comes on a cartridge for the Jaguar, in a box with a manual, all that good stuff. They're shipping it in early December, they say, so very, very soon. And there's video online and lots of screenshots, and looks pretty cool. I'm probably not going to buy it because my Jaguar is broken and tucked away in my garage, but if I had a working Jaguar, maybe I would.
And hey, that name just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah. Rebooteroids.
I think it looks great. I don't have a Jaguar, so I am not in the market for it, but I watched the video of the gameplay and I thought it looked fantastic.
Yep, it looks pretty sweet. One of the things I like with the Jaguar, it is really the last, as far as I know, it's the last video game or computer system of any kind that shipped like with a cartridge port. Like you're plugging in a ROM, you know? Like after that, everything it's all been...
Until Nintendo's next one.
Is that going to have that?
Yeah, I think they're going back to carts.
Oh, cool.
On the Switch, are they not?
I don't know.
I think so. Yeah, you heard it here first.
Let's hope.
You heard it here wrong.
I like it.
Sort of.
If so, I like it.
Yeah, excellent. So. Yeah, I have to wonder how many will actually sell, because it is a cool idea and it looks nice, but I bet there are a lot of people who don't have Jaguars.
Right.
And of the remaining people, half of them have it tucked away in their garage.
Right. Yeah, I think like for most of the things we're talking about, it's a labor of love for somebody. Somebody wanted to do this and has had fun figuring out all the details. And I know it's a bit complicated because the Jaguar has some sort of encryption scheme for the cartridges. And I remember that at some point after they sort of dropped the whole thing, after Atari dropped the whole thing, there was some third party, I forget who they were, that basically they spent a lot of time just trying to brute force the encryption key in order to make their own game. Like they had a bunch of Jaguars set up in parallel, running some code they wrote on a dev system to try and sort of crack the thing. And I think eventually they did, but then also later at some point, whoever owned Atari at some point 10 years ago said, oh, you want this thing? Yeah, here's the key. And kind of let the community have it. So these are, I think it's not terribly complex to make a cartridge in some sense. But on the other hand, it's like for making cartridges for any of the old retro systems. You've got to figure out how to get the right casings and how to get the, you know, the circuit board just right and all these things. So it's non-trivial amount of work. And I haven't even checked the pricing. I don't know what it costs. Okay, $80. That's what it costs.
80?
80. So.
Michael. Okay, so back to Apollo. Can't quite make it, you know, more than a couple of episodes without talking about Apollo.
No, that's right. We need our Apollo fix every now and again. There's always something interesting popping up about the Apollo space mission. So this time around, I've found what I consider an extremely interesting video on the building of the computer modules for the Apollo. This is most of it's at the Raytheon plant. And what I thought was a good follow-on from our last episode where we were talking about big mess of wires. So here's a 1960s version of a big mess of wires. So it's a long video, about half an hour or so, but at the 20 and a half minute mark, they start looking at the memory modules. So it's the process of wiring them up all the way from threading on the donuts onto the frame, and then the wire wrapping machine that will actually harness together all of the individual modules. And this is, at first I was amazed that they're actually doing it via wire wrapping. Now, to me, wire wrapping was, you know, something that was always done for prototyping small run, but I suppose this is a small run. But just the complexity of it all, from the ladies who were just basically using large needles to thread the donuts onto the frames and then having them mounted into the chassis, I suppose, and then having those modules wire wrapped together. So, you know, square sectioned pins, very precise corners on it, and so that when the wire wrap goes around it, it really cuts into just enough into the wire to hold it physically in place. And then all the testing that they're doing, they've got testing modules with paper tape programs to test everything. Earlier in the video, they've got component testing. So it's taking you through the whole assembly and QA process for the computer modules that ultimately we're just going to whack on a giant canister of explosive and chuck a few guys up on the top and then hurtle it out into space. Keep our fingers crossed that it all works and that they come back. And they did. I just find a lot of this archival footage coming back up onto YouTube or others. It's just amazing what we did and how far we took computers back then. So if you're after your real retro fix and want to see some high quality wire wrapping in action, this is the video for you.
Yeah, no, the video is great though. I'll just chime in that I think it's awesome.
And also, I think wire wrapping, I think it was used for production of stuff more than people realized. My aunt worked in aerospace and did wire wrapping for boards and assemblies that were used in military purposes. So, and again, I mean, to the point that maybe it is a small run kind of thing. I mean, maybe it is, but a very fascinating way of putting electronic circuits together. I'm really anxious to see this. I haven't seen it yet.
Just watching the wire wrapping process is amazing. I would have loved for them to have got in closer and actually done more video of it, but obviously they were looking at the entire process of creating the memory modules, the program modules, which were effectively just non-writable memory modules with the core. I highly recommend this video. It is excellent. Old technology at its best.
It's excellent that that it was actually documented too. I mean, that there was somebody there with a movie camera, and this was a movie camera. It was not a video camera. It was expensive to do, I'm sure. Very cool. Yeah, so the thing, the related thing that I wanted to mention was that the Presidential Medal of Freedom was just given out. So U.S. President Obama did a little presentation of the 2016 Presidential Medal of Freedom winners. And it was a very sort of like retro computing heavy list this time. So Margaret Hamilton, who we've talked about before, got one, and Grace Hopper got one posthumously. So, and I looked back through the last few years, and they were pretty much the only sort of like computer related ones that have been given out anytime recently. So that was kind of, that was pretty neat. Also Bill and Melinda Gates got one this time, although it wasn't, didn't have to do with, you know, writing Altair Basic. It was actually about the Gates Foundation work. And I was digging around trying to find like some other connection to make. And so my other connection is that, at MIT, the Status Center is home to CSAIL, which is the, I forget what it stands for, but it's the, you know, CSAI lab. I think that's what it stands for at MIT. And that's in the Gates Tower of the Status Center, which was created with help of Bill Gates. And on the ground floor, there's a big DigiComp 2, which I think I've talked about before. I went in there sometime over, I don't know, a few months ago and played around with it a bit. And the guy who designed the building, Frank Gehry, also got a Presidential Medal of Freedom. So that's about as much as I could pull into this one net. But it was neat though that that was part of the ceremony. So Margaret Hamilton and Grace Hopper have now also gotten Presidential Medals of Freedom, and also gives us another connection to Apollo.
Both well deserved.
Yep, very much so.
I guess there's not much to commentary to add to that, but still. Okay. Carrington, you have the next one.
Woohoo, me. Well, I want to talk about music, baby. I want to talk about music that passes a Turing test. Wait, no, I don't even understand my own thing. It's actually it's an article I found on BBC.com from a while ago, actually from back in October. I just haven't had a chance to actually talk about this, and it's entitled Listening to the Music of Turing's Computer. So super, super, super awesome. I'll keep it short, but everyone should run off and listen to this if you can. I'll talk about that in a second. But anyway, there is a recording. In fact, what is presumed to be the earliest recording of music produced by a computer. It's music that from a computer that the Ferenczi Mark I, I think it's pronounced, which was the first commercially available computer. There's so many firsts when it comes to computers. So this one will be the first commercially available general purpose. There's an adjective for you. But still, super cool and neat that it's got a Turing association. And just mostly neat that this is presumably the first recording of computer music. Music in quotes. First, probably in quotes. Even computers probably in quotes. Everything here is in quotes. But it's kind of neat. It's got a bit of Baa Baa Black Sheep and a bit of, I think, God Save the Queen or whatever. You can go off to that. We'll link to the site, bbc.com, and you can listen to it there, or can you? It's quite annoying. So if I go there, it'll tell me, sorry, you need Flash to play this. I don't want to play it in Flash. So I'll use Chrome to play it because Chrome I keep around because it has embedded Flash. Oh, but no, Chrome's version of Flash on the Mac is too outdated to play it, and I won't let it play it there. There are links to an radio program, the Today program, which I think also include copies of it. So I'm going to keep hunting, and links from this page should presumably lead the listener and hopefully myself to actually be able to listen to this music, which would be the whole point of this, I think. The only other thing I want to bring up, which I think is really, really neat and an example of the little details that go into getting retro stuff correct. People could listen to this recording for quite some time. It's been around since the 90s, just in smaller circles, hard to get a hold of. But what one thing that was known was it wasn't accurate in that the recording was done. And if you listen to the recording, because it was done on acetate, it's presumed the acetate was not rotating at an accurate speed when they made the original pressing, because that's how this like record write to record essentially. Record was playing at the wrong speed, maybe slightly too fast, maybe slightly too slow. That affects the sound when it's played back. But nobody was quite sure what the speed difference was supposed to be. So you'd hear the music, you would just know that it's close but wrong. Because Copeland Long, the people that analyzed this and are rebuilding the original computer, were able to now know what notes the computer can make and at what frequency and such. They therefore were able to analyze the recording and adjust its speed to make it accurate. And so that's why it's making the news again. You can actually hear it the way it would have sounded, but it's taken this long to be able to get accurate sounds out of this recording. And presumably it's going to take just a little longer to make it play on my computer. Anyway. So there you go. There is music out there. It taunts me, and I think it's going to be neat when I can hear it.
What an amazing forensic story.
It's really cool that they've gone to this. I'm really happy that they have. I mean, this is how one, the things one must go to make it accurate. And I'm glad that they're passionate enough. And I really want to hear Baba Black Sheep from this computer. So I'm passionate enough to keep seeking out a way to play it. I'm looking forward to eventually hearing it.
Excellent. Well, perhaps I'll embed it in the end of the show.
Good luck with that.
Thanks. I'll sacrifice a computer to Flash.
Yeah, that's the one thing I haven't been willing to do. I'm very passionate, but come on, passion has limits. I'm not installing Flash on my computer.
Right. All right. Earl, you have some tiny thing to say.
I do, and I'll try and keep it tiny. But I think a little bit of belated birthday greetings here for Tiny Basic, the famous interpreter written by Liu Chun Wang. And it was published in one of the very early Dr. Dobbs, volume 1, number 5. And very well known in the BASIC community, super small. The thing is, when it was originally programmed, you know, we're talking a long time ago, it was done with a mainframe-like cross-assembler that used unusual mnemonic representations. So, and please forgive me if I'm pronouncing your name wrong. It's either Udo or Udo Monk has converted it to more mainstream Intel 8080 assembly source. And he put it in the ZADPAC repository, which is a grouping of software and emulator that lets you live life, you know, the Z80 way, baby. You can find this at altimeter.de, and we'll have a link up in the show notes to avoid you having to type all this stuff. And there's also a posting in the CPM Usenet group, and I like to go to Google Groups to read Usenet. It's nice and webby and convenient, so we'll have a link for that too. So happy birthday, Tiny Basic. I want to say you don't look a day over 30. And also note that this was a derivative of this was the first BASIC that was used on the TRS-80 Model 1 also. Apparently, the Microsoft BASIC was still a little ways away from completion, so they took an adaptation of this BASIC and used it as the first TRS-80 Model 1 Level 1. And you'll like this, Carrington, with your perspective on copyright. The original copyright for this, I think, said something like copy left, all wrongs reserved. it was trying to state in the most definitive terms, you can take this and do whatever the heck you want with it.
That's more definitive than just saying public domain. Oh, nerds.
I was going to say you have no sense of humor, but being a comedian, I think I would be like...
But there's nothing like a confusing, muddled copyright statement to just like mess up everything.
Well, it apparently didn't stop Tandy, and thank goodness. And those original Level 1 machines, I think, are kind of unobtainium these days, too. So anyway, I took something tiny and I made it less tiny. Sorry about that. Turning the mic back over to you, Paul.
I thought, actually, Dr. Dobbs' journal was kind of like a Tiny Basic support for a while. I mean, like, wasn't that sort of its thing for the first, like, I don't know, volume or two? So, but yeah, it does appear to be all, like, I'm looking at volume 1, number 5, which is also in that FTP directory, and it's right here to type in, it looks like, if you want. So, is it me? I guess it's Jack now.
Okay. Almost 20 years ago, in 1997, a guy named Glenn Saunders brought together some old Atari employees to reminisce about the golden age of the video games and to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the birth of the Atari 2600. And this was recorded and put in a videotape, and it was on VHS, but it's been out of print forever. And now, almost 20 years later, it's all up there on archive.org. And it seems pretty cool. I have not watched it yet. It's got a lot of the old Atari luminaries. It's got Nolan Bushnell and Al Alcorn and David Crane and Joe DeCure and Doug Neubauer and a bunch of people. I'm not going to name them all of them, but it seems very cool. It seems like they just had a good time hanging out, talking about the olden days. And now here, an equal number of years almost later, we can all watch it for free.
But you haven't said the best part. It's not just like that it's available. It's the raw camera tapes. It's 14 hours or so of like all the raw and unedited footage has been dumped on archive.org, which is so awesome.
That is awesome. And also why I have not watched it. Yeah. I don't have 14 hours. I don't have 14 hours.
Is there a plan next year to do like a Stella at 40?
Hey, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Gather up those people who are left.
Get on that. Mm. Like, that makes it kind of morbid.
Went dark there.
Stella at 90, you just see an empty room.
But what a great way to preserve it, though. Like, to have filmed all this and have all that footage. It's so amazing that, like, this documentary that was only available on VHS forever. But then to make available all the raw, like, here's everything. 14 right. hours of everything that came out of all the cameras. That's amazing. That's the way to archive something. That's just incredible.
Yep, actually taking all the source material, not just taking a finished product and saying, okay, here's all of it. Do with what you want. It's very cool.
So, but the edited movie is still there somewhere, right?
I haven't actually checked to see that. It could be.
I think that's only available as a VHS copy still. No DVD, no... I don't think you can even watch that on archive.org other than like a rip of the VHS. So there's no good high-quality version of that. But somebody could now take this original stuff and recut the film.
It's true.
Paul.
Right, so yes, exactly. Everyone can just make their own. I don't know if you can.
I'm looking at the archive.org thing, and the Creative Commons license says no derivative works. So it's one of the CC licenses that doesn't let you slice and dice.
Oh, Glenn Saunders, you foiled us again.
This reminds me of quite off topic, but there's a movie called The Tracy Fragments that was 2007, I guess, and I think they released all the, background footage and invited people to recut it. I don't know, Carrington, does it sound at all familiar to you?
Very little does.
Yeah, okay. Tracy Refragmented, made available all footage from the film shoot to download and remix into their own related projects. There was a contest from August 2007 to January 2008. Yes, I remember in August 2007... or whatever, downloading all the footage, but that's as far as I got. So I thought about it, and that was about it, then stopped thinking about it. But anyway, as I say, unrelated. Michael, your turn.
My turn? Well, amazingly, I just have some more Big Iron restoration. It's been one of my favorite subjects this last week or so. So over on GeekWire, there's a coverage of Seattle Living Computers Museum. Plus Labs, let's get the name right, and they have a CDC 6500, a Control Data Corporation, mainframe, and I was just reading through the article and just got to the section which, right beside a beautiful picture of a big mess of wires, so go have a look at the article just for the mess of wires. And they commented on how when the machine had been disassembled to remove it from where it had been installed, someone just cut all the cables that connecting the different units.
Yeah.
And I just love the throwaway line. So I had to buy 50,000 connecting pins at 75 cents each, even though I only needed 10,000 to make my own replacement cables. It took one person 5 weeks to rip out all the old cables and put in the new ones.
Oh, man. Yeah. That hurts. That's so much pain.
Yeah. And then the other one was, we had to also restore the refrigeration unit. Otherwise, if we tried to power it up, it would have been a mess. I love the days when you needed to have refrigerative units, chilled water plants for your mainframes. But, it's... another one of these massive, great supercomputers of the day. I think it... where does it say on how much K that it had available? Yes, the memory is provided by 5-inch magnetic core squares, each made of 4,000 donut shapes of ferrite. Yep, so... Yep. Okay, so... Not much at all. Yeah. It's another one, great pictures, some great video. So if you just want to have a look at, so there's some shots there of someone holding one of the ferrite core memory modules, so little squares there. So it's another great restoration piece. So, you know, I've been looking at what's happening over at the National Museum of Computer with the restorations on some of the old 40s and 50s hardware that they're doing there. So we've got Living Computer Museum doing some great work with more, or I was about to say more modern, but how about just less old might be the way to go equipment. But yeah, another great article on another great restoration piece, and yet again, another reason why I'm going to have to go visit Seattle again.
Yeah, I want to go to there. I'm going to have to make a trip in the next few weekends, I think.
I don't think I can manage it in the next few weekends, but go anyway.
I really like the big, like the round monitors.
Yeah, that's
very cool.
Yeah.
This has there. So the this is a GeekWire story, and they sent a couple of GeekWire reporters to go take the tour and interview people and stuff. And a lot of it had to do with this CDC computer up on the second floor, but there was a little bit on the first floor as well, if you were wondering what the Plus Labs part was about. And actually also Oregon Trail featured in this too, because I think there was a who is it, Monica Nicholsberg as one of the GeekWire reporters, more youthful than the other one. And so she was had said that she'd heard about Oregon Trail and and had actually played it, I think, but on like Windows machines later. And so they sat her down in front of an Apple II, and she tried it for a while, and then decided it was, first thought it was like being in the Matrix, and then decided I can't do this. So
the experience has been ended.
This is really cool though. And apparently it is, it's worth, they said somewhere in the video, it's worth either nothing or everything, because this is the only one.
Yep, and the efforts that they took to restore it, so excellent work.
All right. So I'm not entirely sure I completely understood this, but this is an exploit compromising a Linux desktop using 6502 opcodes. It's a weird story. So it is a 0-day, and it was released with an exploit along with it, but also with a patch.
Which I thought was funny in there. There's one of the facts is like, is it still a 0-day if you release it with the patch?
Yeah. And the patch is basically, delete something. You didn't need it anyway, and it was just causing trouble. But so essentially the core of this issue was that, I guess this version of Ubuntu or something, when it's asked to play an MP3 or asked to play something that uses NSF files, music files for the Nintendo Entertainment System, it actually runs a little emulator in order to, like a 6502 emulator, in order to play these files. And there was a way basically that you could get in and, insert your own code into this emulator, which then had access to the host machine. So really pretty crazy, but 6502 actually being used. So I don't know. Have you all read this as well? Carrington, mm-hmm. Sounds like you had.
Yep. I think it's awesome. I think it's awesome and it's silly. But I think it's great.
It is. Yeah.
It's amazing someone took the time to discover this and figure out they could do it. Like, to find this exploit is amazing, I think.
And also kind of useless.
Yeah.
Because it's not such old stuff. So, but I agree. Completely amazing. Amazing and useless is a good combo.
Yeah.
May in fact be my autobiography title.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah. So basically, I think I'm going to have to update the Ubuntu that's in a VM. This is pretty much the version of Ubuntu that I use in one of my VMs for a little bit of work. Mm. So I feel threatened now by the 6502 machines which are sitting to my left and to my right. They're coming for me.
Well, it's exactly Ubuntu 12.04.5 and nothing else. So.
Oh, okay.
You might be okay.
Okay.
I think it's time for me to update anyway.
But yes, and from what I understand, it gives a different like a higher priority to an older version of the emulator. And so if you just delete the older version of the emulator, then everything will still work, but it'll use a newer version of the emulator that isn't broken. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I can see the thought process that might get you to think about looking here, but yeah, no, it's pretty crazy. Anyway, I thought it's kind of cool to find, you know, 6502 still being useful. So like those little parts of my brain that are occupied by remembering those opcodes is, you know, not completely in vain.
No, you're a lead hacker now.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. I think that's it. Did we make it all the way through all the news?
Yes.
I'm so alphabetically last. So I guess so. And so now a word from our sponsor.
In the beginning, the people who worked with computers were considered magicians.
Abracadabra!
But digital took the mystery out of computers. Digital Equipment Corporation pioneered the mini computer, making compact, easy-to-use systems that can grow with your business. From your independent digital supplier, you can get hardware and software from one source without any hocus-pocus. Digital. We took the mystery out of computers.
And we're back. All right, so being the host, I have been tasked with finding the host's retro computing gift idea, and this is, I'm not even sure, it's a computing gift idea, but the pick I have made is the keyboard waffle iron. So it is, it says it is control alt delicious. But it is it's exactly what you would imagine. It is it's a waffle iron. You know, you use it in the way you would normally use a waffle iron, but the pattern that it makes is of a keyboard. It is $65, at least right now while it is on sale. And so I don't know. I think it's a pretty cute thing. I could imagine getting this for people in this as we go into the holiday season.
This is stupendous. So. It's a little too late to add to my Christmas list, but
is it ever too late?
Oh, no, it's not.
My issue is what I think I'd get it for somebody and they would say that's not a keyboard that they like, or that's not for a computer they use or something. They would argue keyboard layout.
Oh, I've just found my favorite photo in here of the selection.
What do they have?
So just if you go to the fourth photo, it's just shows how it captures the maple syrup ever so beautifully.
Yes.
And the melted
a big waffle.
Oh, that! Oh.
If you go to their Instagram page,
it does.
Their Instagram page also has a nice thing where someone has made something that's some kind of like stacked creation, almost like a cake of keyboard waffles with cream in between them. Looks amazing.
The space bar, evil. It's like a river of maple goodness.
Excellent. Yes.
I love it. I want one. This is going on my Christmas
list. Who wants a waffle iron?
No, it's right, exactly. It's sort of useless on many dimensions, but anyway.
Wonderful.
Even if I only use it once, I want it.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's for holiday waffles.
Oh, yes.
All right. So, now we can move on to further things to purchase by looking at eBay auctions. And Carrington, you have the first one.
Okay, I am going to go with a fairly useless thing that's kind of neat. It's a homebrew IBM Selectric printer interface card. Does it work? I don't know. The description is kind of vague on this. Who made this? How did they make this? And a bigger issue, and also, it's $200 as I buy it now for what is essentially, I guess, a serial card. Here's the thing. This would work, supposedly, with any IBM Selectric typewriter that has a port in the back. I guess they went with serial ports on these. However, those are incredibly rare and hard to come by. So it's not the $200 card you have to worry about. It's the crazy money you'll have to drop to get one of those Selectrics. I don't even know about those. Like, I know there were computer terminals that were based on the Selectric. There's the, I looked it up, but IBM 2741 is one of them. That's essentially a terminal also that looks like a Selectric, so it's using the Selectric ball as it's typing, but it's really a terminal and using the same keyboard. So there's those. There were versions, I think, of the Selectric that were designed to connect as printers. I've got this thing where I love the idea of a typewriter that is a printer. I currently have finally got working my own one of these. I've got a Messenger typewriter, which was the who makes those? I don't know. It's behind me in the dark. Somewhere behind me in the dark.
Smith Corona?
You know what? Let's go with that. Smith Corona. I think it was. I've got a Messenger 3. And you can use those as a printer, and I finally have mine working with my Apple II, and it's been quite an uphill battle because you have to use a particular little box that goes between the two, and then there's no software telling you how to get it working, and it took quite a while. So I'll no doubt want to bring it to Kansas Fest and show everybody, but it's neat to have a typewriter that just types on its own. So that's super fun. This would give you another way to do one of those, but would cost a very, very pretty penny, like a gorgeous penny, a penny that could be a model. But for $200, it begins your journey down to that money pit. Related, if you're interested in Daisy Wheels, as I am, it's my favorite type of printer, even though they're slow, love the clack, love the quality. There's a Panasonic Daisy Wheel printer. Now, this is the... I picked this one in particular. It's another eBay pick. It's relatively cheap, $10 starting bid. Probably no one will bid. You can pick them up cheap. It's the Panasonic KXWD55. I picked this one because this isn't a general use printer. This is actually designed to connect only to the Panasonic laptop word processor. Remember, there was this period where there were laptops. They looked like computers, but they were just dedicated word processors. Panasonic made a bunch of those. This is the printer that would go with one of those. However, this is one of the few ones. It uses a very strange little round serial port. It's like the ADB one, but it's the short serial, whatever that's called. Not RS-232, though. But I have a friend who got this working with his Windows laptop running a relatively late model's Windows. I think he was at the time on NT, something like that. So this is an example of one of the Daisy Wheel printers you can get working, it seems, on relatively modern computers if you can adapt the cable. So I just thought I'd put that out because a lot of them you can't. They're a pain. And then last quick one, one of my all-time favorite games is currently sitting on eBay. I have two copies of it, and I don't really like collecting anything, so I certainly don't want a third. It's $29.95 for a copy of Portal, a computer novel for the Apple II. I have two copies of the novel, the actual novelization as well. I really like this game. So there you go. It's available $30. I think it's worth every penny of that. It's a crushed box version, but you get the map and you get to play a game and then we can talk about it afterwards. So someone should buy it and then play it and then we will discuss. Those are my choices.
Yeah, the box has been Carringtoned.
Yes.
The box has completely been Carringtoned. So yeah, it's pretty beat up, but it looks complete. It's got all the various bits and bobs, including the map and stuff. This is a game. This is a novel that's kind of like a game that you very easily can play in emulation. You don't really lose a lot by not having the original, but it's so good, I think you should have it anyway. So that's why I'm picking it.
Well, I think I'm not going to get it because I can see my copy from here. Sure. I actually got it fairly recently.
This one has been sitting on eBay for a while. This one's been sitting on eBay for, I think, a month, 2 months. So it ain't going anywhere anytime soon.
And if you want to hear more about this, you can listen to the 1 Megahertz podcast, episode 6.
That thing.
Where there is a review of Portal for the Apple II.
I may do another review because it's so good. And I've learned so much more since then.
Excellent. I stuck in the show notes also an ad, as you were talking about like typewriters that you can like plug in to a serial port or whatever, I came across an ad in the spring 1981 Apple Orchard, which I scanned because I thought it was so hilarious. It is a Rochester Data Incorporated provided. Basically, it's a little board that you hang above the keyboard of your actual typewriter, and it hits the keys for you.
The best. This is so much better than the way I got mine working. I love this. Yeah. You're right. It physically actually just types the keys. You can turn. Oh, that's amazing.
I've never seen one, but I would like to have one. I think that is very cool.
Plus, it could be like a really cool shiatsu thing.
Right.
Where you put it behind you and then just start typing out, massage me. And it's,
it's been a hard day. 80 words a minute, baby.
All right. Earl, you have something here.
Well, I love core memory. I mean, first off, core memory is made of little magnetic donuts, and who doesn't like donuts? Right. And they're in the...
donut.
Exactly. And they're, you know, in a nice wire matrix, and it looks cool. The only thing is, whenever I see core memory on eBay these days, it's $50, $60. So this seller has some for $20, and they look like they're in nice shape. And the claim is that they were a Soviet military-used core memory modules, about 10 centimeters square. They look really nice, so I just wanted to pick that. I picked core memory a long time ago from my eBay pick, and I haven't picked it for a while because, you know, if I look at something and the amount of money is too high, I just shine it on. You know, it's like, I don't even care what it is. It's like, you're trying to make a fortune. Don't do that. But these are very reasonable. And so what do you guys think? You guys look at these? They look nice.
Yeah, as long as there's no embedded program in there that could compromise my computer when I hook it up.
Right. Exactly. Well, that's the other cool thing about core memory is it was non-volatile. You turn it off, you come back the next day, your little donuts are still polarized just the way that you left them. I mean,
yeah, there could be a KGB virus still lurking in there.
Maybe really so. Right. No, no, Michael, the donuts are your friend.
So is it possible to actually
cinnamon donuts?
You could just read. I mean, you could just hold this up and read what it is as a human, right? Like what information it holds.
Not unless your eyes are electromagnetic, which would be a really cool adaptation.
Okay.
Mine don't have that. Well,
technically they do.
It's just a way different spectrum. I don't think they physically move, do they? I thought that they just flipped their magnetic orientation.
I thought it flipped the little things. I thought it did move them. Wow, I don't know anything.
Don't know.
Physically moves the little donuts?
I always thought that
really? That's
it. The little donuts flip side to side. Like, I mean, physically they can't. So looking at it, of course they don't.
Yep.
But in my mind, it always was the case that they were like wiggling. I've never seen it in action.
I've never thought about it before, but now that you mention it, I really want to believe that they move.
That would be so awesome.
Yeah. No, but I think the consensus is probably right that they don't, because it does. They're pretty well anchored.
The world became a little sadder today.
Yes.
I should never come on this show. You ruined core memory for me.
Sorry, man. Maybe we'll make one that actually does flip just for you, Karen.
Ooh,
that would be.
Wonder if you could make a waffle iron for this.
Yeah. I have a public service message for our listeners, and that's if you see retro computing books on eBay, be careful, because usually you can get them cheaper. I'm not going to say which one because I'm not a meanie, but I saw a book on eBay, had to do with a computing subject. The book was from the 80s, and the seller had it for $24. I went over to Abbey Books, which is a online used bookseller that I bought a bunch of stuff from and never had a problem, and I found it there for just over $10. So
is that how you pronounce it, Abby? I've always said Abe.
I've always done
however,
Abby.
ABE oh, books, you know, yep. And they just
same,
you know,
same website, works great.
Yeah, they've been a pretty good source for me over the years. So there you go. The more you know. Bong, bong, bong.
Excellent. Yeah, you know, I have considered, you know, sometimes like auctioning off books that I have or whatever, and it does sort of seem like you pretty much, if you're a seller, have to sell them for free because you just can't, you can't even compete with actual booksellers. I mean, they ship things for like 23 cents and, you know, the thing costs $1.09 and it's like, all right, you know, I'm happy to buy it for that, but, you know, I might as well just give these away if I'm selling them.
Yeah, you know, the only one that I ever got a deal on, there was a book, a programming book for the TRS-80 Model 100, and somebody mentioned that it was up on eBay for a ridiculously low price, because it's actually a pretty rare book. I went up and snagged it. So that's a counterexample, but, I mean, normally, you don't want to get them there, because you can find them from a used bookseller much cheaper.
Mm. All right. Let's see. Jack, you have... I don't know what you have. Tell us what you have.
I have something. It's a tiny little handheld or tabletop game console that is kind of a Pac-Man clone. In the description here, it's called Pac-Monster, but otherwise it's normally called Pac-Re Monster. It's made by Bandai Electronics in the early 80s, and it's one of these nice, bright LED games with nice colors and stuff, the kind of thing that I love to have.
All right.
I never saw this back in the day, but it's... It seems very cool. It's got a nice label on the backside describing how to play the game, where your character is called the monster and the ghosts are called bogeys. Look out for the bogeys. And yeah, it just looks pretty cool. It's got a nice. I like the look of it. It's a nice little joystick thing, and just cool. €90 though, it's a bit pricey. But if you're into this sort of thing, it seems nice. I have no idea if the price is reasonable for this kind of thing exactly, just because I'm not familiar with this particular item. But for the right person, I mean, it costs less than that new Jaguar game costs, so maybe more similar. Buy both.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. I'm not sure that I can sort of remember these kind of games, like, you know, this, like the ones that have the fixed LED positions.
Right.
What is the name? You wrote an iOS one.
I've
forgotten the name of already.
Pits of Death, which Carrington lately played and posted in his winning screenshot.
I have played it many times. I have repeatedly come back to that game and then only recently realized that there was the Apple TV version. I'm like, well, let's go back to the pits. I played again and then tweeted my winning screenshot because I beat it. I felt good about that. It is still on my Apple TV. I got to tell you, I keep going back to that game.
Nice.
Something about it.
You're the one.
Maybe, but it appeals to me. And I would recommend it. I find it super fun. It's a neat little logic game, so I like it.
Good. And it's free. Free.
Nice.
Unlike Pac Remonster is not free. It's €90, but
no, £90. Yeah, €90. Very not free.
All right, moving on. I guess Michael, you have special signed copies of something.
Ooh.
Yes. Just recently, I went to a local Apple II meetup here in Sydney. WASFest 5.25. So it was the celebration of the 5.25-inch floppy disk. As well as some video hookups with luminaries of the 5.25-inch world for the Apple. So we had a hookup with Jason Scott from the Internet Archive with everything that's been hosted up there, what they're doing, what they're planning. We also had a hookup with a mystery guest discussing the cracking techniques that are used to recover games and software off 5.25-inch discs. And we had a special guest also with us, Hans Costa, the author of Caverns of Mordia. Now, this is a 1980-82 Australian text adventure game that was released back then with copy protection, which has managed to defeat most of the techniques available. But what Hans has done, along with Sean, the host of the meetup, is that they produced, without copyright, 20 5.25-inch disc editions of the game. The attendees, we randomly drew which one we were getting, so I have a lucky number 13. But what they're doing is they're posting up number 1 and number 20 of 20. So basically it's to some money for Hans and a little bit to sort of like help cover the costs of reproducing all of these here. So I thought it was great that we actually have an official recreation of the software from back in the day. So in this case, not only was the permission of the author gained, the author actually got involved and provided an unreleased 1984 version of Caverns of Mordia. So this version, so anyone who has played this can now play the unreleased, updated 1984 version of this game. The disc image is available, the manual's available as a PDF, but if you want the feel of it all, here are two eBay auctions that you can actually get an original game on floppy disk with an original print manual.
Nice.
Very cool.
So, as Sean said, bit often, bit high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the game, you know, from the past, but
I can't quite remember the quantities. Hans did comment that the number of purchased ones, I think we're still only talking around 1,500 copies. So it was a very small release, but nonetheless, it's a little piece of retro gaming history that has been brought back to life. And what I like about it is that if this meetup hadn't been organized and this all arranged with Hans, it's quite possibly that the 1984 unreleased version might never have got released. So it's just a very small piece of computing history, but I just like how, you know, that's now up on the Internet Archive, and hopefully it's going to be there forever, or at least as long as the archive exists.
Right. Okay, I will move on to at least some of the ones that I have listed here in the show notes. But okay, so one thing that caught my eye was this thing. The auction is called Diskkeeper Plus V3OB Executive Software. And, you know, so it sort of seems like just software. But the picture is of a tape. It, actually, as it turns out, it's a for a VAX. It's VMS software. So you put it in a like a some kind of deck tape machine. And so it looks kind of cool. It's kind of interesting to see how this kind of software was distributed back before they were distributed on floppies. And it's, I thought it was sort of interesting just in that it really doesn't say anything about it. It just says, like, presumably the seller doesn't know what it is. You know, it says, this is a Diskkeeper Plus V3OB executive software, all the stuff being, like, just read off the label. But so if you, and I looked into it a little bit, it is, it's fixed disk defragmenting software for VMS, I think, 4 and 5. So if you happen to be in the market for such a thing, you also need the machine ID of the machine that was originally paired with, because it's protected. So not very useful, but it is only $15. anyway, I thought it was kind of cool to see. For some reason, I assume people sell these things on eBay with some regularity, but this seems like the first one I've come across that caught my attention. So it's got a nice little hook on it for hanging on a rack of tapes. Has anyone worked with these tapes in real life?
Well, not the VAX ones. I've worked with tapes and having to get the software sent in and then organizing for the tape to go off to the library and having, you know, the whole process of installing software on the mainframes back in the days was somewhat more difficult than it is these days. Basically, with downloadable releases and everything, it's no more difficult to install than it is on a PC. But back in the day, you had to literally get the tape, get it mounted, restore the files, then go through the installation process. If there was an update to the program, yep, get a new tape, have it sent in. I've got a few tapes that I managed to keep from the years, but it was definitely a slow and painful way of getting stuff loaded, especially if you didn't have direct access to the drive yourself.
They do seem like at this point they're just kind of art. I mean, it's sort of sad in a way, because if there is somebody who has a drive and wants, you know, tape 2 of 8 or whatever, and you have put it up on your wall, then this is not good for anyone. But let's see. So I'm going to move to another, speaking of art, there's a Mac Plus Walnut cabinet, which came up just before the show. I thought it was pretty weird looking thing. I don't know if this was... It kind of looks like it was intentionally made for this. There was someone who sold this little walnut cabinet that a Mac Plus fits in exactly.
It does seem branded. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're embarrassed by your Mac Plus, you can put it in a piece of furniture.
Or think it didn't overheat enough.
Right. There are vents on the top, I think.
Yeah, I was looking at it and I'm going, so if you don't like the look of your computer sitting on your desk, you go and put it inside this walnut cabinet and you sit the cabinet on your desk. I'm trying to figure out which one to me actually is the more aesthetically pleasing. It's a nice little piece of cabinetry, though I'm not a great fan of the walnut. But,
and based on the size and overall look, I think people would assume it's full of booze.
And then they would be pleasantly unsurprised.
It's like, oh, the booze is in here. Oh, no, it's not the computer.
Oh, it's a computer.
It's a flying toaster.
It's just so weird, though. It looks like a little punishment thing. Like the Cool Hand Luke of early Macintoshes. Like, I got 7 in the dead and 1 in the box.
It reminds me a little bit of what people would do with their televisions, you know, back when it was embarrassing to have a television in your living room. Put it behind
some sort of
embarrassing
to have a television.
Well, maybe the Mac made too much noise and that it's a soundproof cabinet.
Yeah, this will kill it, so it'll be silent.
That's right.
No, I was just sort of wondering whether I should buy it anyway.
Yeah.
We should have a woodworking thing at Kansas Fest and you just make your own.
let's see. I'll mention Mosaic in a Box. Actually, there are a couple of these out there, so I just sort of picked one. In 1995, the web was new, and NCSA Mosaic was kind of like the web browser. And there, for a while, on the Windows platform, people were selling boxed copies of Mosaic. So,
but Paul, why didn't they just download it?
Right, exactly. Seems like they should have thought of that. But yeah, so this was before Internet Explorer was even out, you know, and it was, certainly wasn't included with Windows. So the Spry company was the one that sort of started the Mosaic in a Box, and they sold this. And the link I've got here is to one such box, still shrink-wrapped. It advertises some stuff about, let's see, if you get this, you get access to Hotland, which is sort of like top links on the web. Early Yahoo, I guess, of some sort. Mm. Yeah, it's pretty interesting to see. There's a couple of versions you can find. So pretty quickly after this, CompuServe bought Spry. So there are also, if you look around, you can find Mosaic in a Box versions that are CompuServe branded as well. They don't feature Hotland.
It'd be fun to have a browser that only browses like 1995 versions of everything. So it just uses the Wayback Machine or whatever. So if you go to a site, it just brings up the 1995 version. It's like, no, this is a 19. And the other thing is, I guess nowadays you can fit two or three hard drives in this box and could probably contain the web from 1995.
Right.
Like with modern drives, to say, I got a few 6 terabyte drives. So you know what? There you go. You got 1995 in a box. I would totally buy that.
That is actually a pretty good gift idea.
Yeah,
I think you let off might have been one of the very first gift ideas that, and you've mentioned it I think since the idea of giving people a subscription from the past.
I've done that now. Yeah. For Christmas last year, I actually gave a friend of mine a subscription, and I have been all year long mailing off, and I have been informed that it would be very nice if I renewed that subscription for next year. I'm like, really? I've now locked myself into sending you magazines for the rest of my life. So that's the downside to that plan, but it was a big hit. Yeah, I gave somebody a one-year subscription to an old magazine.
What you do is you get the same 12 magazines again and just say, well, you weren't clear enough as to which year you wanted to resubscribe to.
Right.
Yes.
Or go backwards, you know, to the year before.
Right.
Oh, I like that. That's a good idea. You've learned all about 1985. Now let's learn about 1984.
With this knitting magazine.
Right. That's the way to hurry up and get the requests to stop.
I must admit, I did actually buy this back in the day.
Mosaic in a Box?
I think a lot of people did.
Yeah, Mosaic in a Box. Yeah, it was literally the easiest way to get it. And then basically you'd get new versions and updates. They'd be on the software on magazine cover discs and things like that. So it was a totally different world back then. Because now it's that thing. So catch 22. You know, what do you need to download it? You know, oh, you need it to download it.
Right.
And you know, unless people were able to do an FTP or some other connection to get the software, so they could go and have their web. Yeah. It was, you know, an interesting time. That But as I said, I actually bought Mosaic in a Box. I don't think it quite looks like that. I'll have to go for a dig to see if I've got it. Might have been one of the CompuServe ones. But, most of the time I just took it off the when they started getting them on the magazine discs, on the 3.5-inch discs or the later on the CDs, just getting the updated version.
Yeah, this kind of thing was probably a popular way for people to bootstrap themselves onto the internet, though, yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
Right. Hotland didn't last.
No, I'm not even remembering.
Or maybe it turned into something else.
The other thing that was popular out there were internet directories, so you could actually buy a magazine book style thing which actually had little blurbs of different companies or products and with the URL in there for you to type in and go off and have a look at it. So it was a very different time.
That's right, I remember that. My cousin worked for Boardwatch for a while, which was like the premier magazine for BBSs. And when the internet came along, they started to try to adapt to, as I recalled it, turn into a magazine that would give you information about what was going on out on the web.
Top 10 new games and interesting items. Even the magazines used to have a section on what's out there on the internet. So, love those days.
You can subscribe to a fax newsletter about what's hot on the internet. Be the ultimate.
Right.
Well, you guys are reminding me of the Dilbert where the pointy-haired boss man says, I don't have time to surf the internet. Could you print it for me?
Yeah. I'm going to axe a couple of my auctions and add one more, which is the whole internet guide and catalog. So there were a couple of editions for this. I just found one that's being sold for $3 buy it now. So it might even be okay to buy it from eBay instead of going to other booksellers. But I have a version of this. I don't know if it's this exact one, but this is a 1992, just sort of, it's like Yahoo printed on a page, basically. Yep. All right, so I will just close, I guess, with bringing back kind of what led to that topic was that there, first of all, there's a Kenback 1 replica, so now there's a link, and we can look at it and talk about it. So it's pretty. It's very pretty,
So pretty, yeah.
I mean, it's blue and silver and has little punch buttons and there are nice pictures of the inside and everything. So Earl, maybe you can jump in here. I'm forgetting. It's the same person who made the Altair 8800 clone.
That's right. And I think his name is Grant Stockley. Mm-hmm. Kenbackkit.com is where I found it. Uh-huh. Yes, that's right. And I don't know that they're available at the moment. I mean, these were very limited runs and pretty expensive and made in absolutely meticulous detail with original case specifications. Everything except the power supply on this baby was just like the original. So it's a very, very nice replica. Mm. And the Kenback one is one of the computers that stakes the claim as being the first personal computer, right? I mean, it's a controversial topic, but...
Right. Quotation marks everywhere.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, on all words in the sentence. But it is pretty. I'll give it that, man. It is to have one of these like on a shelf, I mean, I wouldn't drop, what is this, $4,000 or $5,000 or something ridiculous, but it is so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And useless.
Yeah.
Can you imagine actually using this thing?
Yeah, I didn't even know like what it does. I mean, I suppose I can add some numbers or something, plot some trajectories.
I guess, but this is just the buttons and the shape and the color.
It looks to me similar to the PDP-8E that a professor dragged out in college. That was like we basically use the switches to like choose a memory address and say go here, and you use switches again to say okay now set this value in the memory address. You can sort of punch an old program that way. And then jump to an address and run the program from there.
Like the Altair.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's probably the same kind of deal with this. You can sort of feed in a program.
So there's no web browser for it then?
I'm afraid not.
Probably not.
You can get the whole Earth guide or whatever.
you can just list all the possible programs you can put in it. but apparently it's like no microprocessor or anything. It's just TTL chips. It was mentioned, but this is a starting bid of $5,000. It's quite possible that that's not insane, for what it would have cost to get the kit before.
Sure.
And I don't even know if this could even be the person who made it, who is selling it. I don't know the eBay ID. So
probably a limited market, though.
Yeah, that's true. And then the last one I was going to mention was this particular one I linked to was Beagle Brothers Typefaces for Apple Mechanic. And it has a little card, looks just like the front of the manual, disc with a label that looks pretty accurate to me. All of this stuff looks quite accurate, as if you had bought it. I think the ad is great. I mean, it in itself is nice with all, it has embedded little, these like woodcut pictures and stuff that were probably lifted from Beagle Brothers art themselves. And it's highlighted everywhere. None of the physical media described in this listing is original. So it is apart from whatever reservations there are about copyright and replicas and so forth, it is a really well executed thing. The seller stuff keeps coming up on all my search lists because, I'm searching for these things and I look at them and they look real and then I click in and then I go, oh, Foxtrot Gifts. Okay. It's a replica. So if you look at the other items from the seller, there are many of these generally Apple II themed things. And actually, I'm hoping he's not selling any originals because I don't know how to tell the difference.
Right.
I guess as long as they're all reproductions, it's at least possible to tell from who the seller is. But so if you wanted to see what we were talking about, this is, it's kind of weird, actually. Like, typefaces for Apple Mechanic doesn't seem like the kind of thing that people have a lot of nostalgia for. But don't know. Anyway, they're nice, though. I mean, you know, I appreciate the effort, and I could see doing that kind of thing for myself. And then I can sort of see, like, if you're doing that kind of thing, why not let other people benefit from it? But, you know, and then we're back to the host topic.
Right. But even that, I'm looking at the Beagle Bag listing. So it's $13, a little expensive because really all you get is a disc, but has reproduced the disc beautifully, reproduced the little statement of quality form, but you don't get the manual. Instead, it's just like a little one sheet that says the user manual download is available. But that little one sheet saying the download's available is really done in the Beagle Brothers style. So it's really well executed. I mean, totally a knockoff, but a really well-executed knockoff, I gotta say. This is better than I could do.
Yeah, right.
So I kind of appreciate the weirdly, I'm appreciating the quality of this ripoff. It's, I don't know. I really like it. But, I mean, all you're really getting is a disc. Do I want to spend $13 for a disc? But, man, this guy's making the discs right.
Yep. Yeah, and, I mean, you know, Beagle Brothers lends themselves to this. If anyone out there, you know, if you're not an Apple II person and you haven't come across Beagle Brothers, go look them up because it's worth it, even if you're not an Apple II person.
Yeah.
They're a fantastic company.
And you're right that the ad itself, like the description on the eBay ad, is done. If the Beagle Brothers had eBay ads, this would be it. This is really just, it's done with love, clearly. And larceny. Love and larceny. And I dig it.
I will leave my eBay auctions at that point, and we can move to closing discussions, since it has been a while since we started. Carrington, you being alphabetically first, are first to go.
Do I have anything? Oh, I do! Red Dwarf. I'm a big fan of Red Dwarf, even though it's so poorly written, but I just, I love it. And so, new Red Dwarf came out recently, and hooray for that. And somebody discovered secret sounds in the closing theme song of Red Dwarf, from the beginning in all versions of Red Dwarf. How cool. So if you listen to the closing theme of Red Dwarf, there's a point where it just sounds like some music's playing, but it's actually somebody speaking the words Red Dwarf, Red Dwarf. And so it sounds like it's like through a vocoder or whatever. And so somebody noticed that recently and said, hey, I just noticed the words Red Dwarf are spoken in the instrumental closing theme music. And the person who wrote and recorded the instrumental closing theme music said, oh, it's about time somebody spotted that. How cool. I left it as like a little neat Easter egg. So that's really neat. I would love to have put a link to this in the show notes, but the person who found it and then was lauded by the person who did the recording, they stuck up that little snippet, like a little video snippet on YouTube to say, hey, like, here's what you can. Well, that account has now been terminated for copyright restrictions. So, bummer. So, but I'm sure if you just go looking for it, it'll no doubt be floating around. Or if you just listen, next time you're watching Red Dwarf, when it gets to the final theme song, listen, you'll actually hear the words Red Dwarf spoken as music in the instrumental theme. So that's kind of cool. But too bad the person who found it and then was lauded by the Red Dwarf people then was removed from YouTube for cause. So there you go.
Yeah. That's cool, though, and I never noticed that, and I will definitely go listen now.
And if you listen, it's totally obvious. I was like, I cannot believe I never noticed this in all these years. So it's really cool. So that's what I got. That's it.
Excellent. Okay, let's see. Anyone else? Michael, you have written something. Oh, and you do have something. Tell us about this.
I shall. Okay, back in show 138, Paul had a auction item for a Microsoft Havoc, and I resisted and resisted and resisted, and then at the last moment, I went in and bought it. And at the meetup, which I talked about for the Caverns of Mordia, I took along the Havoc because I knew this was going to be a good place that if there were any problems with the machine, that I would have about a dozen people clamoring to get their hands on it and help me diagnose and fix the problem. So we took the machine apart. I resisted the temptation to power it up untested. And I had to wait for a step-down transformer anyway, because it was only capable of consuming half-strength electricity. We have full-strength electricity here in Australia, so I had to be careful. And we stripped it down, opened up the power supply, had a look, and the general consensus was that it looks like this machine's hardly been used at all. Everything was clean. Even the motherboard and everything didn't have much in the way of dust or anything in there. So, no, just checked it out. Then we put it back together, plugged it in, powered it up, and lo and behold, it booted up to the MicroSci 3.1 firmware boot screen. We got a sacrificial floppy disk and put it in. The drive looked good, but we still didn't want to put any classic software in, and that booted up. So it's all alive. So now I've got to find a spot here in the bunker and set it up, and going to try and track down documentation and everything for it. I've got a few magazine articles and press releases in magazines for it, and that's about it so far. But no, it says it's 80% compatible with a sort of like an Apple IIe. Beautiful keyboard movement on it. I love the keyboard. It's an ugly little creature as far as it goes. So I'll have to get the photos and everything that I took, put them up on the Apple II Enthusiast Facebook group. But I'm going to have to put them into a blog so the wider world can see the MicroSci Havoc in all its ugly splendor. It's really growing on me now. I think I'm actually thinking it's a cute, beautiful little machine, but boy, it's ugly.
Yeah, no, I am quite curious to know how compatible it is too. I assume you tried to run something, right?
Yeah, it was just a basic diagnostics disk. It came up with the menu and everything, so it was fine. I had also purchased a copy of Ultima 5, complete with the TTL map and all the other bits and pieces. So I thought, what the heck, opened up the box, took the 5.25 disc out for the boot, put it in, but that was, let's just say, Ultima 5 is in the 20%.
Yeah.
So.
Not surprising.
Yeah, so.
Very cool.
Would have been interesting. So had that hooked up to one of those little night owl security monitors. So I've at least done one little bit for the world. I've shown that the night owl security monitor is MicroSci Havoc compatible.
It's going to be a popular combo.
I'm sure. Yeah, now I need to see if Protoss, whatever it is, 241,
yep,
will boot. But
yep. Yeah, I'm going to have to work out the pinouts because the external disk connector doesn't use the same size pins as the Apple, so my floppy emu, I can't connect that at the moment, so I'm going to have to make an adapter to go in between. But in the meantime, I'll just have to write 5.25-inch discs and do it the old-fashioned way.
Excellent. So I guess with that, I will wrap up the show. So that is it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCRpodcast. You can send feedback to us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network, which is at throwbacknetwork.net. Please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro-compute!
Compute.
Not in the mood. I left him.